Hi there, and welcome to Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. And today is the great and joyous Indian festival known as Diwali is taking place around the world. The music which you can hear a little there. In Australia, it's also marked by tragedy and some sadness as members of the community mourn the violent death of 29-year-old Manmeet Alisher, killed when a man set him alight in front of passengers in a suburban bus in Brisbane on Friday morning. And so we're going to give our first hour to the Indian community this evening, particularly to the celebration of Diwali, and also perhaps in memory of a much-loved character, Manmeet Alisher. Elsewhere around the world, the government of Turkey today continued its harsh round of crackdowns, sacking up to 10,000 civil servants, including academics, teachers and health workers, linked to the United States cleric Fethullah Gulen. And I understand up to 15 Kurdish-linked media outlets have also been shut down. And over the border, Iraqi and allied forces continue their advance to liberate the city of Mosul from ISIS. Mosul was at one time a major Christian centre. As ISIS overran the city, many Christians were forced to flee, and the Catholic Chaldean archbishop at the time was Bishop Emil Shimon Nona. Well, Pope Francis recently appointed Archbishop Nona to Australia. And earlier this week, he spoke with our own Andrew West.
Archbishop Emil Shimon Nona was the last Chaldean Archbishop of Mosul before he was forced into exile after the ISIS forces took over. He joins us now. Archbishop Nona, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, you have been keeping a very close ear and eye on the situation in Mosul. What can you tell us about the situation now as the forces attempt to retake the city?
The situation of the city of Mosul is very difficult. From 2 years, ISIS have control of the city of Mosul and the plain of Nineveh.
How many Christians fled Mosul after ISIL took over in the middle of 2014?
About 120,000 people. We left the city of Mosul and all the plain of Nineveh in one night. All those people.
We know that you had to lead your people out of Mosul. Were any Christians able to remain? Did they go underground and hide?
We think that there is a few people who didn't leave the city. I know personally one family, parents and two children, and we don't have any news of them. We don't know if they are alive or they died.
Where did most of the Christian refugees go when they left Mosul? Where did you go?
We go toward Kurdistan, north of Iraq, because more safe for Christians. And the majority of them, they are still in the north of Iraq. But a good number of Christians, they left Iraq toward other countries like Jordan, Turkey and Lebanon.
What sort of conditions have the refugees from Mosul been living in Kurdistan and in Lebanon, the other places where they have fled to?
The situation of refugees is still very difficult. After 2 years, you can imagine that one family can live for 2 years in containers, like containers, without any job, without any hope, without anything. Just the churches help them to survive in this bad situation. But other people who are in Lebanon or Turkey or Jordan, they are waiting to be accepted in other countries like Australia, Europe and America.
So they were living, though, in containers, like shipping containers or storage containers. These became homes?
Yes, yes. They are still for 2 years. They're living there.
Is it now the hope of you and the other Chaldean Catholic Christians that you will be able to return to Mosul?
The people who are still in the north of Iraq, sure, they are waiting to go back to their homes and to their properties and to their works. But it's not easy. It's very, very difficult.
These were, of course, the ancient birthplaces, in many respects, of the Eastern Christian communities. Do we know what sort of damage has been done to the Christian holy sites in the areas that ISIL took over?
In general, they keep the churches without any damage, but we know that where there's the sign of the cross in the churches or buildings, they are destroyed, all of them.
Before the takeover of Mosul by the ISIL forces, what was religious cooperation like in the city of Mosul?
I was in Mosul from 2010 till 2014. There were always these groups, they called Islamic State. They were underground in that time, but with other people, like normal people, Christians and Muslims, they lived together in a good relation.
If the Christian population can return to Mosul, do you think good relations can be restored?
I don't think that Christians go back to the city of Mosul exactly. A few people, maybe. Second thing, I think the relation between Christians and Muslims in the city of Mosul, it's not as easy to be like before 2014. You know, when the ISIS came, there was very bad behavior from other people who we lived with them for many years. And many of them, they became easily with ISIS. So I think not as easy that Christians go back to city of Mosul.
Recently appointed Catholic Archbishop Emil Shimon Nona, Chaldean Catholic Archbishop of Australia, formerly Archbishop of Mosul in Iraq. He was speaking there with Andrew West of the Religion and Ethics Report on Radio National. And so now to Diwali. It's India's big festival. Diwali means rows of lighted lamps. It's a festival of lights and all Indian Hindus celebrate it. During this festival, people light up their houses and shops. They worship Ganesh for good welfare and prosperity, and people also worship the goddess Lakshmi for wealth and wisdom. So to discuss Diwali and how it's to be celebrated in the growing Hindu and Indian communities of Australia, it's a great pleasure to welcome into our Sydney studios Nim and Ash Gorka. Welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, John.
And in Melbourne, Brahmin priest Bhakta Dasa of the Hare Krishna movement, who are celebrating their 50th anniversary in Australia this year. Welcome, Bhakta.
Hare Krishna, John.
Thank you. And right from the start, we should acknowledge the sorrow many in the Indian community, particularly in Brisbane, are feeling on this, what should be the happiest night of the year, with the death of someone who seems to have been quite a character, Manmeet Alisher. Bhakta, how would people in the community be remembering this today?
Well, it is a very tragic situation that's happened, John, and it's a dampener on the whole Diwali, all the Indian community here that I know of, and we don't really know this gentleman, have been touched by this sad event, so it really has changed the festive mood in a sense. It's darkened it, unfortunately.
Nim, is there a sense of community in the diaspora that it reaches just beyond your local community, and there is a sense that he's one of us and that this is a tragic thing to happen, even independent of whatever meaning is given to the event?
Absolutely. I think, like it was just mentioned, although I didn't know him personally, it does feel like someone very close has lost a life. So it is quite sad.
Yeah, you see those images, the video images of him independent that friends have shot, and you just get a happy character that emerges out of this.
Indeed.
Yes. So we shall just remember those who suffer with in memory of Manmeet this evening. But let's talk then about Diwali. Ash, what is Diwali for you as a Hindu? Why is it important? Is it a bit like, say, Christmas for Christians? Is it that sort of festival where a lot of, not only do you have the religious meanings, you have a lot of other things attached to it, such as family and other things?
That's interesting. Certainly as a Hindu, Diwali means is especially special, having grown up in India and seen the fireworks and the festivities and the bonhomie associated with that. But certainly living in Australia, we celebrate Christmas as well. So it really is a matter of, you know, keeping the balance. And we encourage our children to continue the tradition, so as to say.
If you are just a member of civil society in India, not particularly religious, if you're that sort of person, Diwali is just a good time to have together. It has sort of different layers of meaning for different people. So would just an ordinary Indian celebrate Diwali? It's just a cultural thing. This is a good cultural thing, and we should get together and have fun. Is that?
It is cultural, but certainly there is a big religious connotation. As with any religion in the modern world, it does tend to get commercialized. And Diwali is no different. I think what people need to really keep in mind is that the significance of Diwali is associated with the return of Lord Rama, one of the Hindu gods, from exile. So there is a deeper philosophy and religious significance attached to it.
Mm-hmm. And again, that is like Christmas. You've got the layer of the Father Christmas and the happiness, but you have a deeper layer of religious meaning that people who are serious about the culture and their religion can really participate quite deeply. Because I understand, Nim, that it runs for over a week.
That's right.
Different things happen on different days during that week.
Well, for different communities, the main day of Diwali tends to differ. But as far as my knowledge is concerned, and my family, which is a Maharashtrian family stemming from Maharashtra in India, we do it stretches over 5 days. Yes,
and five exhausting days. I mean,
5 days of fun, 5 days of love and laughter. So yes, and there's a lot of shopping for new clothes. It is really a period of renewal, of hope and light, and that's how we were raised to believe in the festival. So it's a very positive time of the year, and that's what we try to get our children to believe in as well.
Bhakta Das, just give us an insight into the religious significance. What's it mean in the centre of the tradition?
Well, the actual word Diwali breaks up into two words, Deepa, meaning light, and Avali, meaning carrier. So it signifies coming to light. So Diwali really signifies victory over light, over darkness, so good over evil. And the festival also symbolizes a time of spiritual renewal by lighting a lamp within our own hearts for spiritual enlightenment and welcoming the Lord back into our lives. This is something that's missing a lot in material world, that we forget that actually everything comes from God, and we have an opportunity to reestablish our connection with God. So
that darkness into light theme is, of course, there in Christianity as well. It's there in Judaism. That is a deeply felt central core of most major religions, that at its heart, religion is about transformation and about transformation for the good.
Yes, exactly. That's correct, exactly. There's a verse in Vedic literature, and it mentions Tamasa Maha Jyotir Gamaya, which means don't remain in the darkness, come to the light, meaning come to the spiritual awareness or awakening that actually there is a much greater power and energy in spirituality. And sometimes we forget that in the material world.
Mm-hmm. Ash, what does it mean for you? You'd consider yourself as a family, a good Hindu family. So what's the balance of that religious teaching? What, for instance, would you be saying to your children about?
Well, it's really about them connecting with gods and goddesses. There's plenty of them in Hindu religion. And it's really about them trying to see what can they get out of the festival. It's really hard explaining to them the significance in Australia. Out here, Christmas is big. And we celebrate Christmas as well with the Christmas tree and the presents without the religious significance, but we use that as a time for family gathering. Not different to what we are trying to do with Diwali as well. It starts off with exchanging of gifts and so on. It's really about imbibing them an understanding of what is the spiritual and the religious significance of it. With kids, I think really it's more about sowing the seeds at this age. Later on, if they get to the point of having spiritual awakening in future, that might be the time where they're seeing the fruit of the efforts that we are putting in today.
What sort of stories would you tell them? I mean, it seems to me that Hindu literature and all the great books are full of tales, of stories of heroes, gods and goddesses, epic battles, but stories of great love and tenderness as well. What are the stories that come out that you'd tell the kids at Diwali?
Well, first of all, every time I go to India, I go to the bookshop and buy comics. So it's all visual. My Gen Z kids, a very attention span of a goldfish, as they say. So I tend to buy a lot of comics with a lot of pictures and things like the Ramayana and Mahabharata, which are, two great books of Hinduism, again, in picture form. Diwali stories, again, come down to the same thing. Lord Rama returning from exile and things like that. So we try to simplify it as much as possible so that they are aware of the core tenets, but at the same time, I retain their interest without getting them bored.
If I was to ask you in this context, Bhakta, what for you would be the central themes you'd want to pull out? If you're talking to people and introducing them to Diwali, what would you be saying to them this week, or what have you been saying to them this week?
Well, it's quite interesting that you mentioned that because we had a Diwali celebration at Parliament House here in Melbourne for the whole of this week. This was the first time that a parliament anywhere in the world not only celebrated a Diwali festival, but for 3 days afterwards, we the Hindu community, all various groups from different organisations and mats and temples, set up little stalls in Queen Hall in Parliament House. And there we actually presented aspects of Diwali, but also different aspects of our own teachings. And so, we really clearly tried to point out to the politicians, and it was quite interesting. We got an opportunity to go into the actual parliament and watch them perform, which was quite a shock. And, we actually talked to them about the fact that they're not these material bodies. We are not these material bodies. We're actually spiritual sparks. And it's on occasions like this that we are reminded of that transcendental spiritual essence that we all are and our connection to God. And so this is what we were reiterating. And this parliament was overwhelmed with the different ministers coming and listening and actually really appreciating it.
That's quite a coup, really.
It was. It hasn't happened anywhere in the world where a parliament. Well, we've got a parliament in Canberra, Federal Parliament House. There'll be a Diwali celebration also next week, and hopefully the Prime Minister will be there. As same in the White House in America, the President will usually give a speech to the people present at that Diwali celebration. So it is a huge event. And again, it always has there is the celebratory aspect as well, but there's also that deep spiritual understanding of what society really needs at this point in time.
Nim and Ash, the Hindu community in Australia is one of the fastest growing subcultures in Australia. And temples are going to be appearing in communities and are already in ways that they, a generation ago, Australians, this would have been utterly different for them. How is the community itself developing? Is there a much stronger, in the years that you've been growing and part of this, is there a much stronger sense of self-identity beginning to emerge? A sense of your participation as Australians, but also of who you are and the rich traditions you've come from?
I would say yes and no. As an immigrant, we are very often straddling two cultures.
Yeah.
And I think that sense of belonging and the sense of loss tends to battle with each other over the years. Mm. But like you rightly said, I've been in Australia for 20 years, and the initial sort of loss of identity has slowly dulled over the years, and it is gradually emerging a sense of identity, yes.
I remember talking to a friend of mine who is British, and he went to Canada, and he was a leader of a sort of an artistic group, and he was a musician and work in a composer. And I remember sitting in his lounge room in Canada and speaking about what it was like being in Canada for some years after leaving England. And he pointed to a row of his most prized sort of literature and other books, and he said, "See those? Don't read them." I said, "Why not?" He said, "Because the community here is far more conservative than the community I left." Is there something of that too, that the emigre community feels an obligation to hang on to things in a way that the home community doesn't
anymore? I think so. I mean, I go back to India and I remember the India I left behind and expected to still be the status quo to have been maintained. But like you said, they've moved in new directions, directions I wasn't aware of, and it's always a surprise. So in many ways, the community here is sometimes more conservative than perhaps people back in India.
Bhakta, let me ask you about this too. The Hare Krishnas, let's talk about you. You've got something to celebrate at the moment too, because you've been here in Australia 50 years. Your introduction to Australia, like your introduction around the world, it reminded me very much of some of those early evangelical Christian groups that sprang up, like the Salvation Army and other groups. You know, they're going around the street, marching bands and other things 100 years ago, and people looked at them very oddly. And the Hare Krishnas arrived in Australia about 50 years ago. And guess what? Jingling symbols around the streets with it. Hello, you know, just change the colour of the clothes. What have we got?
We had a lot of similarity to the Salvation Army and those sort of organisations. It's true. And in the beginning, it was a bit of a shock. Then there was a bit of a rebellion. What are these people doing on the street? And then after a while, the local council said, actually, they bring colour to the streets. We'll actually enhance it and allow them to do it. So we don't do it as much anymore because, guess what, we all grew up and had to work and had families. So there's still a couple of times a week that we get out there and we chant. It's really good fun. You know, it is enlivening. We're chanting the holy names of God and encouraging people to, again, like I said, become aware that there's more to life than just the mundane day-to-day events. So, yeah, we've grown. It was a movement that started in 1966.
It came out of sort of, in the West, it came out with a great attachment to popular culture as well.
Yeah, the hippie culture.
George Harrison.
Harrison was one of our followers. Initially, it was the Lower East Side of America, the Bowery, and the hippie class from San Francisco that took it up, and they thought this was really far out, man, you know. So, and then it just grew. We matured, and people started studying the Vedic scriptures and applying it to their lives, and finding that this was actually very, very satisfying.
So you found that over the 50 years, you've moved from being a fringe, somewhat esoteric group into the more mainstream and absorbed or become part of the great river of Hindu culture.
Oh, absolutely. We now have over 650 different centres and temples around the world, including Russia, China, various places all over the world. And in particular here in Australia, we very much work with the Hindu community. We work in capacity of, say, doing chaplaincy work for people in hospitals, retirement villages, refugee centres, and so on and so forth. And we also work, and this is the other point that you were making as far as the culture of India, we work a lot with students that come. As you said, there's an expansive growth of Indian migration, and especially in the student sector. And these young men and women that come, and they come on their own most of the time, they actually feel a disconnect. They miss the culture of their home. And so when they come to one of our temples and they have the traditional foodstuffs and they hear the chanting, they've got a place. They've got a home here in Australia. And so we really encourage them and we work with them. And this is really, really important. Because they do it hard. You know, these students that come here to study, they do it very, very hard. They have to study very hard. They have to work very hard. Their fees are exorbitant. Mm-hmm. And so we work with them quite a lot. And again, through the Hindu community, in communities such as the Hindu Council of Australia, HOTA, which is the Hindu organisations, temples and associations, those sort of groups, we are now coming together and identifying the needs of the Hindu community. And it is a big, growing community.
Ash, let me bring you in here. How did the community react a few years ago to all that stress, particularly among a number of students? And there was said to be violence in sections of Melbourne against members of the Indian community. Was there a sense then of stress on the whole community? And was there... Have you ever experienced the sorts of things that some of those kids went through? Is there still elements, pockets of racism, I guess, anti-Indian racism that you've encountered in Australia?
Fortunately, I have not encountered. I came as a student myself in 92. And in fact, as Swamiji said before, I've had the joy of going to the temple, the ISKCON Hare Krishna temple, and having the prasadam, the divine prasadam as well. So thank you very much for that. No, I mean, there is an angst at times. You know, it's a sense of the community. People don't live as individual units. Mm. We live as society. We associate with like-minded people. And certainly if there are any incidents of violence, as happened a few years ago, then it does trouble the entire community. Mm. I personally don't think that there is any racism. There may be, there is always going to be patches of, you know, us and them at all times. But I don't think that, you know, what happened was certainly not appropriate. But the authorities did a good job, the politicians, the police and so on in, and also the media, which also has a, you know, big role to play in calming everyone and soothing their angst.
Yes.
I would agree with you, Ash. That was a really significant time where everybody came together and said, enough is enough.
Hmm.
Yes, and we should point out too that with the tragic death on Friday, nobody is as yet saying that that's racially motivated. It seems that we're dealing with somebody who is profoundly disturbed in some ways too, and we should make that point. Bringing up a family that wants to keep hold of the traditions, it's okay. Little kids want to absorb the stories of the traditions. They do get to an age, however, where their mates down the street don't do that. Mm-hmm. They do something else. How is this for a family that's not only from a different country, but from a different cultural mindset and a different religious tradition, a profoundly different religious tradition? I remember when I was a child, Protestants and Catholics didn't speak to each other, and they were Christians with different cultures, and it's a natural thing for kids to want to reach out to their friends. How do you face that as a parent? What do you hope to do as a parent?
Well, firstly, we've raised all our three children to believe in themselves as Australians of Indian heritage. Hinduism, in my personal opinion, is a way of life. And we try to give our children, both Ash and myself, all the exposure we can in small doses to their cultural roots, because they were all born here, raised here, and that's really their only connection with understanding the Indian sort of cultural background and landscape. Having said that, though, we don't really push it down their throat, so to speak, small doses. And we believe that all the years of upbringing, when we've taught them to look at life in a certain way, which of course has subtle connections to our cultural background, will hold in good stead as they grow older. And eventually, it's their individual decision how they, what paths they choose to tread on. And that's up to them as adults.
You're on Sunday Nights on ABC Radio around Australia. John Cleary with you. We're talking tonight about Diwali, the great Hindu festival being marked this week. And our guests in the studio are Nim and Ash Golkar. together with Bhakta Dasa, a Brahmin priest with ISKCON, the Hare Krishna movement, you may know it as, in Australia. And you're welcome to give us a call if you've got any questions or queries. 1-300-800-222 is the number, 1-300-800-222. The Hindu community is Australia's fastest growing religious and ethnic subculture. 1-300-800-222. Remarkable growth over the last 20 years or so, and sooner or later you're going to run into a Hindu temple around your community. Ash, give us some idea of what going to a Hindu temple means. Is going to temple something like going to church? Are there different temples to different gods? What's the linkage between the temples? How are priests selected for the temples? How does it work?
That's, the question really is very broad because it goes down to the essence of Hinduism. Really. I mean, yes, you're absolutely right. There's multiple gods, multiple goddesses, both female and male form. Essentially, temples are dedicated to a certain presiding deity, as they say. But then there are also going to be some of the others, which may be important in other temples, playing a secondary role in one of the temples. There is no specific routine as such. You go to a temple whenever you feel like it. You go, you sit down, you pray. If there is a priest around at that time, there are certain rituals and so on can be performed. If nothing else, if it's a weekend, most of the temples out here do serve sumptuous lunches or some prasadam. You can certainly go and feast on that.
So that's a way of bringing people together.
It certainly works in our family.
All that yummy food.
Yes.
You can't keep them away.
That's for sure.
Now, if I was just happening to wander down the street and wandered into a Hindu temple, because I just wanted to be, feel part of it, introduce myself around, would I be welcome?
More than welcome.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wouldn't need to feel that I'd violated some sort of ritual by stepping over the into the temple with it being profane or something like that. It was just part of being a normal person. Can sort of wander.
No, the Hindus are very accommodating and very much appreciating other religious traditions. Mm. I just wanted to point out one thing actually, that the majority of people that follow the Hindu tradition, or as they like to be called, Sanatan Dharma, or the eternal service to God, the majority of Hindus are monotheistic in that they believe in one God, much the same as Christians, although they may worship different demigods, which are sort of departmental heads. The CEO of the company is God, God in the form of either Krishna or Vishnu, like that. So this is, and if you come to a temple, they'll clearly explain, that they have a great affection for Lord Jesus and Muhammad and so on and so forth. So it's very accommodating.
Yes, Hinduism seems to be absorptive of others. Mm-hmm. That is, welcoming everyone into the great search, as it were, for truth, rather than saying, we have one truth and you're going to follow it.
Yeah, exactly. Very much so. Everybody has their path to find in their own way and according to their desire, according to the modes that they live in, either passion, ignorance or goodness, that will determine where they go and due to their karma also. Because the Hindus believe very much in reincarnation and also, many births, and they believe in karma. For every action, there is a good reaction. For every bad action, there's a resulting action again. So, these are different fundamental truths that all Hindus believe.
You're on Sunday night. We're talking Diwali, the great Hindu festival of lights taking place around the world this week. You're invited to join us for a few questions, 1-300-800-222. Let me ask you each, before we take some calls, over recent years, we've seen a resurgence of Hindu nationalism in India, and we're seeing groups like the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, and they seem to be adopting an exclusivist view of Hinduism. That is, it's our national religion for our country, and these other faiths don't belong. How does that fit with the great Hindu tradition that we've just been talking about, that absorptive tradition?
I don't think that is the case. BJP has not really, and I know of quite a few of the BJP functionaries, both here as well as overseas in India. I can certainly say that what they believe, there is a sense of nationalism and pride, but that really comes down from what they see as perceived many years of subjugation.
Mm-hmm.
Despite India being a free, free of foreign rule for almost 75 years or so, there still has been a inferiority complex to a certain extent. The entire dialogue, educational dialogue as well as general communication and so on, has been where anything that was foreign or Western was viewed as superior. So BJP coming to power, all that they are saying at this point in time is, we've got this glorious heritage and glorious past which has just fallen by the wayside. Can we sort of bring that back to the mainstream again?
What about those who want to say that bringing it back includes some very old traditions which you're not really sure about, like the caste system and other things?
The caste system was actually not a legitimate Vedic tenet at all. The caste system is something that was unfortunately concocted. The genuine caste system means that a person has an occupation or a position in life according to their propensity. So say, for example, if a person is a high court judge, it doesn't necessarily mean that their son or daughter is also going to be a high court judge. So in that way, everybody has a propensity to either be a priestly class, a managerial class, a mercantile class, or a labour class. The choice is always up to the individual and where they fit comfortably and in their position in life. So it's not something that is, unfortunately, it's been made into a birthright, but that is not the case. That's not how it is presented in the Vedic teachings.
Mm. Ash, how do you respond to what Bhakta has just said?
No, absolutely. Completely agree with him. If you look at what's happening, because Hinduism and especially the Indian society has been around for a long time. For example, the city of Varanasi or Kashi is the oldest continuously inhabited single place on earth. And if you go back, it really, the caste system originates from people passing on their skills and so on to their children. And again, the reason for that in the old days was the lack of, books and so on, things like that. While they were there, it was just easier to teach your own kids to follow in your family footsteps. So that's
And people do pass on the trade, father to son, no matter what the culture is. I mean,
that's right.
There is a tendency to do that. 1-300-800-222 if you want to talk about Diwali or the Indian diaspora in Australia, the growing Hindu community in Australia, or the 50th anniversary of the Hare Krishna movement in Australia. How did you feel first when you saw the Haris on the street in your neighbourhood? 1-300-800-222. Let's take a call from Peter in Warrnambool in Victoria. Hello, Peter. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Yeah, what would you like to say?
I think you were referring earlier about racism in Melbourne, racist attacks on Indian students.
Yeah, 3 or 4 years ago.
That's right. I think, if I remember correctly at the time, those attacks were carried out by newly arrived immigrants.
I'm not sure if that was correct.
I think they were, and that at the time was why, in one respect, why the police weren't adopted that idea of not giving out actual descriptions of people. Whereas normally they'd said someone was Caucasian, 5'10" or blue eyes or whatever. They went through a period where they stopped giving out descriptions of the attackers, and yet people had seen them. And it eventuated, or turned out that it was because they didn't want to sort of have people going on about immigrants.
So,
in fact, that's just about all those attacks, I think, were carried out by the newly arrived immigrants as much as the APEX gang.
All right, Buckner, have you heard that take on that story?
I haven't. I actually haven't. I can only commend the Parliament here at that stage. It was Ted Baillieu and also Mr. Brumby, who on a bipartisan level straight away handled this situation and alleviated the stress that was there. That all the Hindu community felt, and I commend them for the work that they did at that time.
Thanks for your call, Peter. But I'm not sure that I can find Benny who'd take your view on that. Let's go to Craig in Queensland. Hi, Craig. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Thanks, mate. How are you?
Yeah, great. What would you like to say,
mate? I grew up in the Illawarra, and I used to work in Sydney all the time, and. You know, you'd finish work and you walk down the street and you'd see the Hare Krishnas down there, and they'd be singing and chanting and carrying on, and it was awesome. You know, it really brightened your day. Like, I live in central Queensland in Mackay, and I work out in the mines and that, and you don't see them anymore. You know, I really miss the brightness that they brought to the community, and, you know, it's a shame that they aren't widespread in Queensland as well. You know, like, my wife's grandmother is Hindi, and she's the most loving person and accepting person. Like, I married an Indian woman, and she's just fantastic, the way she treats me and the way they've embraced me and their family.
That's great. That's a good story. And that's something for you to take away, Bhakta?
It certainly is. We're desperately trying to do more Sankirtan. It's called Sankirtan. Which means communal glorification of God. The fact that it makes you feel so good is because you're actually in touch with that small spiritual spark within you and connecting that with the greater spiritual spark, which is God, Krishna.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing is, which Nim mentioned before, you know, as far as the food is concerned, we're also known for that. The Hare Krishna movement all over the world is known as the kitchen religion. And people have really taken to us both for food relief work that we do when there's times of tragedy, but also through our restaurants that serve absolutely delicious, and temples, absolutely delicious meals. So, Craig, I hope that I can fulfill your desire and we'll start chanting in the streets of Queensland very soon again.
Oh, I hope so, mate. I've still got your stickers.
Your boys
give me a sticker, and I collect mining stickers. And front and center in my sticker magazine is in my album is the Hare Krishna sticker. So
which one is that? The big smile one with the big eyes?
The big smile like a sun.
That's Lord Jagannath. Lord Jagannath is the Lord of the universe, and he has
it's
a big
awesome.
Smile.
It makes me feel happy when I see it.
Good on you, Craig.
Terrific,
thanks,
Craig.
Guys. Have a great night.
Thank you. And we ought to say, Buck, you mentioned food, but for those of us who've been around the big cities for a while, it should be food and film. Govinda's was famous for
movies. Oh, absolutely.
And,
yeah.
Get a good feed and watch a good movie. There was nothing better on a Saturday night.
Still happens. It still happens. Yeah.
Yeah, we can't plug those on the ABC, of course, can we?
Of course not. No,
no, no. No, we couldn't possibly. Couldn't possibly. Before we take some more calls, I've got to ask Nim and Ash something here, because this is really endlessly fascinating, and I've deliberately held it off because we don't want to spend the whole night on it. But you two did not meet until very close to the marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Nim, how long was it before you wed that you met your betrothed?
Well, I met him at 6:30 one evening, and 8:30 that same evening we were unofficially engaged.
2 hours.
2 hours later. And 21 days after that, we were married. And it was on the day that we were driving to the marriage venue, it hit me. And I thought to myself, wow, I don't know this man at all.
A similar story happened with us, John, which was not me personally, but one of the devotees got married in a similar sort of way. And they drove away from the marriage ceremony, and he got pulled up by the police. And the policeman asked, so what's happening? And he said, oh, we just got married. And he said, so what's your wife's name? And he said, I don't know.
Now, Ash and Nim, you are an example of an arranged marriage that used to be a strong part of European tradition till 400 years ago, is still part of Indian tradition, and you seem radiant beneficiaries of the tradition. What do you say about it when you talk about it to your kids?
Well, our children only recently found out that Mom and Dad had an arranged marriage, and the look of pure horror on their faces when I told them how long I knew him before I said, oh, yes, I'll marry this man. They were horrified. So, yeah, it's quite comical.
Ash, any second thoughts? Please feel free to, you know, declare them into the world.
No, I absolutely. I think, it's just been fantastic. I mean, I'm glad that it's worked out well. Put it that way. It doesn't always work out that way, but usually it works out because it's the families that have a big say as well. Mm. At end of the day, arranged marriages is more about the families coming together and jointly making a decision. I mean, at end of the day, the husband and the wife get to say yes is after a lot of filtering and the initial pre-selection that really happens at the beginning.
It may surprise many of our listeners to know that up until the late Middle Ages in Europe, and the whole story of Romeo and Juliet and Shakespeare comes out of a period when arranged marriages were the standard thing in England and Europe. And the reason Romeo and Juliet was such a scandal is because at that time, for a priest to marry young people without the parents' involvement was regarded as him supporting fornication. And that aspect of the Romeo and Juliet story is lost on European culture today. They just don't understand how scandalous not only Romeo and Juliet were, but the priest was for daring to marry them for love. He would have been chastised by his bishop. 1-300-800-222. Time for a few more calls. Let's say hi to Poonam in Kew in Melbourne. Hello, Poonam. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, great. What would you like to say?
First of all, I want to say happy Diwali to all Melburnians and all the Hindus all over the world. Just finished an evening of celebrations. I've got candles lit everywhere in my house at the moment. Unfortunately, can't have them lit outside because it's so blowy and windy. But really, I've enjoyed the whole session listening to your guests and agree with most of it. What I wanted to say was really just add a comment about resilience of the Hindu religion. And in my opinion, the reason being that in each and every Hindu household, there'll be a little temple in our homes. And the religion is essentially handed down to us by our parents, by our grandparents, who tell us stories about the mythology. And that's how we learn. And that's why I feel, and even for us, I've been here 35 years and we've got two kids, grown-up kids. And even though they might scoff sometimes at, you know, things we do and rituals we perform and all that, but I am sure through seeing what we do and practicing what we practice, that they have, you know, really taken in a lot. And even today, as we were doing our prayers, they both joined in, and their cousins were here. They all joined in, and it's really heartening to see that that they have got that part of the culture, even though what they see outside of their homes is so different and so varied. And so, yeah, I feel, living in Australia is just the best of both worlds.
Well, that's a great endorsement. Nim and Ash are nodding their heads in furious
totally
agreement.
Very good point, yep. Poonam.
Thank you. And Nim, I completely agree. I was shaking my head madly about, you know, when you were narrating your story about meeting your man and getting married and being introduced and all that. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's such a familiar story. We have a similar story, and you know, within 10 days we were married, and he had flown off to Australia within 15 days. Mm. And you know, it's just when we talk about marriage in India, the one word that gets drilled into most youngsters is compromise. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that holds us in really good stead. I'm not saying that all marriages are happy in India. Mm-hmm. They certainly aren't. But it does work, and we have several examples of it. So
that's true.
It's interesting that the TV at the moment has an experiment, a social experiment going on. You know, Marriage at First Sight or something it's called. And it's just, it's hilarious, actually, to watch that.
Very true.
But anyway, that's all I wanted to say.
Thank you very much, Poonam, for your call, and great to talk to you. We can't even let you get away either without saying you are the author of a book on your experience, subtitled Diary of an Immigrant Bride. Mm-hmm. It really is a personal journey that wrestles through many of these little pathways we've touched on this evening. Why did you write it? What was the purpose?
Well, first of all, I must clarify that it is not my story, although vignettes from my own experiences as an immigrant bride have, of course, found their way into the book. The reason I wrote Diary
it's
of...
It's a sort of... It couldn't be described as an Indian Bridget Jones diary. It is a novel, but it's taking us in a little bit more seriously than Bridget Jones.
Look, I loved Bridget Jones, so it is one of my favorite books and movies. But I wouldn't really say it is a mirror version of it. I sort of delve into a lot of cultural things as well through the book. To answer your question, why did I write this book? Is because in many situations, an Indian girl who opts for an arranged marriage goes in with the mindset of the man I marry is my friend, lover, and mentor all rolled into one. And then I wanted to find out what would happen if a girl like that were to meet her soulmate after marriage and it wasn't her husband, and the dilemma that would go through her mind. I wanted to explore would her upbringing sort of kick in at that point in time, or would she then think, I get one shot at life, I'm going to follow my heart. And I wanted to explore, because I'm sure that happens, and how would a girl in that situation deal with it? And that's how the book was born.
Diary of an Immigrant Bride. And the main title is what? Just remind us.
So it's Unraveling Anjali.
Unraveling Anjali.
Anjali is the protagonist, the young Indian bride, and then the tag is Diary of an Immigrant Bride.
There, folks, something to take away from this evening and sort of meditate upon it yourself, read it and enjoy. We've run out of time. We've got 30 seconds left and that's all. Nim and Ash Golkar, it's been great to have you with us tonight. Thank you so much for
thank
giving
you,
us your time.
Thank you, John.
And Bhaktadas, thank you so much too. If there's one thing we could take away from Diwali for each of us as Australians and all those flashing lights, what is it? Put a candle in the window or a firework in the heart? What should we do?
Learn to love one another.
Learn to love one another. Lovely stuff. Thank you very much. And, of course, the music will take us to other places. You're on Sunday Night, back after the news. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.